broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio is Joel Hewish.
Morning, Louis. Morning, listeners.
And Brett Dickinson.
I'm here too.
Hello.
Hey.
Have you guys had nice weeks?
It's been a busy week. Yeah, lots going on. Yep. Yeah, but it's all good. All good stuff.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent.
The year's well underway.
Yeah, it is. It is. I had a bit of a summertime cold this week.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, which is
Corona?
Not a lot of fun.
Man flu.
Yeah, man flu. Thanks, Joel. Yeah. Thanks for your support. No travel to China lately, so not the coronavirus.
Chinese friends that visited?
No. None of that. And I'm still alive too.
Yeah. So good signs.
That's a good sign. Yep. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And in other news this week, President Trump is still the president.
Well, he's still alive as well.
Yeah. He keeps going.
He does. He gets knocked down and gets back up. And yeah.
What a total waste of time.
It didn't seem like it really had much chance of getting up in the first place. I think Nancy Pelosi had been storing this one away ever since probably Bill Clinton went through his impeachment trial.
Yeah.
He's got off, although not without a backhander to Mitt Romney, apparently. Mitt Romney was the only Republican to break ranks and vote against or vote for the
impeachment.
The impeachment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating. And all Republicans, apart from Mitt Romney, just holding ranks and stepping in behind the president.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this sets up quite an interesting prelude to the 2020 election.
Yeah.
I think was always their strategy. They pretty much knew that they were not going to get enough Republican senators to flip to actually go ahead with the impeachment.
Probably not. Yeah, I think what their tactic might have been is to raise enough doubt that any swinging voters may swing across to the Democrats.
Mm, that's right.
As a result of these types of collusions, perhaps.
Yeah.
But you have a very strong U.S. economy right now, and you have a president that is enjoying the fruits of that strong economy, getting a trade deal done. I'd be very surprised if Trump doesn't win the 2020 election. Historically, the precedent has been that you don't usually kick out a president after the first term unless the economy is doing very poorly. That's not the case. The last two presidents to leave office after one term were George Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
He was flying high after the Iraq War, and then all of a sudden the economy tipped into recession in the early 90s. He was kicked out, and in came Bill Clinton, and prior to that was Jimmy Carter in the 70s, and we all know that what happened over there when he bungled the Iranian abductions and rescue mission, and also the U.S. economy was in the doldrums with the oil crisis and in the 1970s.
Mm. So you really need that large dissatisfaction amongst the greater base of the public.
Correct.
Which just doesn't really come along if people are comfortable in their jobs and comfortable in their life.
High employment, increasing wages growth for the first time in a long time, although it's not very strong, it's still happening. They set up a pretty stable economy, sets up a very good environment for a re-election. So we'll see what happens. Michael Bloomberg has entered the race, and he's now starting to charge in and spend a fair bit of money. So it's probably the only legitimate mainstream candidate on the Democratic side.
And we were a bit confused about that, Joel, because we were wondering if he was in the race or not. Because he hasn't been a feature on the TV in the Democratic debates.
No, he hasn't.
And he wasn't a feature in the Iowa caucuses, which happened over the last weekend, US time.
Mm.
Which turns out he was just late to get his application in.
Is that right?
That's what it came
that's
down
what it came
to.
Down to.
So okay. he because he was a late entrance, he didn't qualify to be a contender in Iowa.
Right.
So what I've read is that Iowa is where all the candidates try and get a win. Because it's the first, it gives them momentum.
Right.
So people put a lot of money into winning Iowa. And Buttigieg, who is the winner, great name, President Buttigieg.
Buttigieg.
or Butt-Edge. But in fact, there's T-shirts that he's put out on how to pronounce his name properly.
Oh,
Butt-Edge Edge.
Is that what it is?
It's Butt-Edge Edge.
Butt of a few jokes.
Butt-Edge.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Butt-Edge.
Also okay. The first Butt-head. Openly gay. That's right. The first openly gay candidate.
Right, there you go.
To run. So that name just ties in well to be the butt of a lot of jokes. Anyway, so he sunk a lot of money into Iowa, and no one knew him well. I mean, we're outside America, so we only see what we read and hear.
Yeah.
But that just wasn't a household name, but now he's won Iowa. So now is a household name. That gives him momentum. But for someone like Bloomberg, he's put all of his money, he skipped Iowa, he's put it all into New Hampshire, which is the next one. So look out for him storming ahead in the next one, and then the whole series from there.
This could be the battle of the billionaires.
Mm.
Could be.
And Bloomberg has deeper pockets than Trump.
He does.
He's worth about $50 billion, Mike Bloomberg.
He is...
How much?
$50
billion. Wow.
I read he's the 11th richest person in the world.
Yeah, that'd be about right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of his interests are media interests.
Financial. Yeah, financial media.
That's highly influential.
Yep, that's right. So... It's fascinating.
It will, If he is the Democratic nominee, it will be an interesting presidential campaign.
Absolutely.
Well, and we saw one of our business associates in Brisbane had a friend come back from Hawaii over the summer, and they had the new Trump campaign hat.
Oh, yes.
Remember he had the Make America Great red hats with the white writing? Looked almost identical. I think there was just a slight change to the slogan. It was Keep America Great,
Make America Greater.
Make America Greater, yeah. So that's what we'll probably be hearing in the coming months as we lead in.
I'm so conflicted. Oh, my goodness. Anyway. Trying to be neutral and impartial here, but I'll grip my teeth, and Joel's going to tell us how good it is for financial markets.
Not in regards to politics. In fact, I've got some statistics and some interesting research that has come out over the last week or so around the impact of disease outbreaks or virus outbreaks and what the impact of that is on stock markets. So we've had a number of different instances where the World Health Organization has declared emergencies or epidemics, and when that tends to happen, believe it or not, it's actually bullish for stocks.
Right.
So in the lead up to the World Health Organization declaring a state of emergency, the market typically falls. So generally what tends to happen is that the news starts to break that there's something going on, right? But the World Health Organization hasn't yet sort of declared that this is an epidemic and that we need to be on global alert. But by the time the World Health Organization announces that this is a serious problem, that tends to be when most people in the financial markets are starting to have already discounted this in as a potential risk factor. And so it tends to then be a catalyst for stocks to turn around and actually perform quite well. So I've got some interesting statistics here. So on the day that the World Health Organization makes its announcement, 12 months after that date, stocks on average, when looking at the SARS in 2003, bird flu in 2004, swine flu in 2009, wild polio virus in 2014, Ebola in 2014, and the Zika virus in 2016, stocks on average 12 months later were up almost 20%. This is according to the performance of the Morgan Stanley All World Index.
Right, well,
so this is global stocks. Yeah. Global stocks. So that happened about a week and a half ago, ago, and the stock market pretty much bottomed a couple of days after that. And the 4% correction that we saw in stocks largely around the world has now completely reversed, and we're now seeing stocks even higher than where they were before the virus really became a bit of a concern almost 2 weeks ago now.
Okay. So stocks had gone down by about 4%, which
this,
can be
this time around. This time around
can be attributed to the news around coronavirus.
Yeah, generally stocks are off around about in the lead up to the World Health Organization in the month leading in. They're really off not that much at all on average. You know, about 1%, 1.5%. It's barely registers. When we had the swine flu in 2009, in the month. Prior to the in the month when the oh, where does it say here yeah so in the month after the World Health Organization makes the announcement, swine flu were actually up 11%, SARS were up 8.6%, Ebola were down 7.4%, and Zika's down 6.1%. But 6 months after that, pretty much all of them except for a couple of except for Ebola, stocks on average were positive 6 months later down the track, and up, you know, double digits in many instances.
Yeah. Fascinating.
So,
okay.
So if you're using this as a reason to get bearish or concerned,
there's no substance to that.
There's no real basis for that to be the major catalyst. What is more important is, you know, what the fundamentals of the stock market are suggesting.
Okay. So don't change your position based on coronavirus.
No. In fact, coronavirus looks like it was actually very positive for Tesla.
Really?
Well, I'm sure it had absolutely bugger all to do with the coronavirus. Yeah. But in the last week since we raised Tesla, Tesla's share price has gone to the moon on a SpaceX rocket and back.
Oh, I'm still amazed by this story. How is it happening?
So just a quick one. So in the last week since we last raised our discussion around Tesla, it had rocketed from $640 up to $968.
What?
And it's now come back down to $740 just in the last 2 days.
Wow.
That is essentially a 50% increase and a 25% decrease in 1 week in Tesla's stock.
Volatility.
Incredible. Yeah. So the stats with Tesla, and this is one of the craziest stocks I've ever seen in my whole life. Like, the polarization of the bears and the bulls is just incredible. And what we've seen in just the last three trading days is that the free float, so the actual tradable float in shares on Tesla shares, have turned over to the full value of its entire free float. So the amount of shares on offer to be traded in Tesla shares have completely changed hands one full time in just 3 days.
What?
That's just incredible.
Has that ever happened?
And what seems to be driving this, yes, there was a large short, open short position on Tesla. There's, you know, huge short interest on Tesla shares. It was somewhere around about 20 or 30% of its free float was sold short. So there's suggestion that there was a major short squeeze where, as the share price kept on rising, these short positions just capitulated and had to go and buy the stock back. But that's not all. That might explain part of the increase. But in the US, there's a discount broker. In fact, I think there are no brokerage charge broker called Robinhood. Now, it's largely tailored towards retail investors. And on Monday alone, there were 12,000 accounts that bought Tesla for the very first time in Robinhood.
Right.
And they were buying for over $700 a share. So the share price today, last night, closed at $740. Now, what that suggests, that if the share price got to $968 and it's now trading at around $730 something, and the whole float of Tesla's share had share has changed hands, that there's potentially more people now that are on a loss that currently own Tesla than actually
because
are
of
at a profit.
The timing of that changeover.
Yeah, correct, correct. Even though the share price is up somewhere around about threefold in the last several months.
But that, the converse of that means that there's got to be a lot of people that have made profit, taken it and left.
But what this typically this is typical capitulation, euphoric end to a stock price rise, when retail investors come in right at the last minute, institutions are able to sell and dump their shares to these suckers, and you end up seeing huge losses for retail investors. So this is typical of what tends to happen. And
now you have investor psychology kick in, because the majority of today's shareholders are sitting in a loss position. What are they going to do? Mm-hmm. What we know from behavioral finance, and I've touched on this before, is that people tend to hold on to their losing stocks for longer than they hold on to their winners. So you've got a huge crowd of people who are going to hold on to those stocks for a long time in a loss-making position.
Yeah.
And that's effectively going to put a cap on how high Tesla will go from here. So Tesla is going to struggle to break past its previous high.
Yeah,
because it's got all of these shareholders. All they want to do is get their money back.
They want to, they'll wait until the share price gets close to a break-even position, and then they'll look to sell. And if the share price doesn't get to a break-even, they'll hold it and ride it all the way down.
That's right. And then when the share price does get up, it'll probably take years to get back to its previous high, although who knows,
because
it's so volatile.
It's one of the craziest stocks I've ever seen.
That's right.
It's been a massive pump and dump almost.
It has been, it's been crazy.
Just to put that in context, a pretty ordinary share like Commonwealth Bank tends to have a daily volume of just over $200,000traded in the Australian stock market, and it has a market cap of $149 billion. So let's just even it up. Let's take let's round it up to 200 billion against a daily trading volume of 200,000, like a billion to 100,000. How does that maths work? So it's about 1/1000th of that company gets turned over every day. And you're talking about
0.1%.
Is it 0.1%?
Is that what a thousand?
I'm not certain that would be. I think the turnover in CBA shares would be a bit higher than 200,000.
A bit higher?
Quite a fair bit higher.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah,
so
yeah,
it might be up to 1%.
Maybe I'm off by a zero.
Yeah.
All right. So let's say 1/100th of CBA gets turned over every day.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the whole value of Tesla
in 3 days.
Yeah. Which is just
33 times in that effect.
Correct. Yeah. Which is just nuts.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah.
I'm calling them the Nick Kyrgios of the stock market. You just don't know what's going to come next, but you got to watch.
One of the things, though, I think it does highlight is the potential for sharp, sudden movements in stocks, both to the upside and the downside, in a day of computer age trading. Tesla has been a bit of a flash in the pan of what could potentially happen when, full blown panics in a world of computerized momentum trading can kick into full swing. And what conceivably could happen on the upside can also happen on the downside. We are in a potential environment where we could see a potential melt up in stocks. But and if that happens, fantastic. But it's also an environment where you need to be aware that things could turn and turn quite quickly as well. So risk management, manage your stop levels, manage your position sizing. All of these things need to be considered in this environment, even though it could be quite a fruitful environment for stock investors for the rest of this year.
Very interesting, Joel. Very interesting. Let's take a break now. We'll be back shortly.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Brett, let's kick it over to you.
Sure.
Let's talk about property markets.
Well, in particular, let's talk about some commercial property for a change.
Yeah.
We're typically biased with a lot of what we talk about here towards residential for a couple of reasons. One, we research it a lot more. It probably suits our audience a bit more because pretty much everyone that would be listening to us or that's a client of ours has to live somewhere and more than likely would like to own that, whereas they don't always want to own an office or own a business that would need to own or lease an office. But that doesn't mean that it's not a market to keep an eye on and potentially invest in. The challenge with investing in commercial real estate, though, is a lot of the time it's priced significantly higher than residential property. It's very hard to just go and buy a small commercial unit, maybe a small shop or, you know, a bit of warehouse, an office building. You know, typically they're not strata titled like apartments are. So it's generally the big institutions that own them or the big funds and REITs. But you can obviously invest in those. But to give some perspective to how the property market for commercial, I think, is closely linked to residential in some ways. And hear me out here, because I'll certainly come to light once I paint some stats. So I looked at some vacancy rates on some reports that came through. Any idea what the vacancy rate in Melbourne or Sydney is on commercial property? Talking CBD only
right,
here.
Right now?
Yeah, right now.
I think it's about 3%.
Yeah. Good guess.
Only because...
You've seen it?
Well, only because we're negotiating on our lease right now.
Yeah, there we go. And you've probably got some relevant information to what we're talking about here.
I actually had no idea, Brett, because I only look at the residential market and I know the vacancy rate on residential, you know, if it's very tight, well, then it's as low as 1%, but it's generally about 2% and maybe as high as 3% in a not very good market.
Well, and that's probably around Melbourne and Sydney. Some you know, other CBDs get as high as 6.
In commercial?
No, in
residential.
Yeah,
right, okay.
Yeah. So a poor supply-demand scenario in terms of vacancy rates can be as high as 6 residential, whereas commercial, it's actually, you know, quite sparse in terms of the variance. We look at, so Melbourne's the darling of it all. Melbourne's CBD offices have a vacancy rate down at 3.2 at the moment.
Okay.
Which is leading the country by a fair way. Sydney, not too far behind at 4.3. But if you go all the way out to Perth, it's at 19.1.
Wow, 19.1.
Yes. So significant vacancy rate.
19.1, one in five.
Yeah.
He's vacant.
He's empty. Yep.
Wow.
So Canberra is at 10.3, Brisbane 11.7, Adelaide 14.1. And then I just thought, is there any regional cities that we could have a look at? I can only find data quickly on one, and that was Wollongong's only at 9.1. So there's less vacancies for offices in Wollongong than there is in Perth, Adelaide, or Canberra, or Brisbane.
Wow.
But the parts of it that I thought were interesting, though, is, okay, so that tells you that Melbourne and Sydney are the two best markets for commercial property, and that probably makes sense because they've got the highest population, most population growths, and they're where the residential markets are growing the most, typically at any given time.
What was Brisbane? Do we have Brisbane stats?
Yeah, Brisbane was 11.7.
11.7.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So we don't track and research this as well, but if you look at the markets that are the deepest and you know, have the most transaction volumes and the best growth for residential, it is Melbourne and Sydney. So I guess when we link the commercial property to the residential property, you'd say, well, where the population is, where people are moving to, well, there has to be jobs. And if people are going to move there, they need to believe they're going to be able to be employed. So that means there has to be a lot of big businesses and therefore there has to be office space or commercial space actually being available to those businesses and companies.
Yeah.
Some other interesting things, though, is as the CBDs of Sydney and Melbourne grow, the fringes are starting to grow and almost be priced the same.
Really?
In some capacity. So Melbourne's almost got a quasi Silicon Valley of its own. So if you look out to the area of Richmond or Cremorne, that's actually grown significantly. And prices out there are comparable with CBD offices in terms of square meter rates.
Yeah.
So, and you look at some of the tenants that have moved out to Richmond, you've got the likes of Bunnings, Uber, Afterpay. You've got Reece, Seek, realestate.com and Domain are out there. Even Myob have established that as their preferred head offices.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not just the CBDs of Melbourne and Sydney that are doing well, because in Sydney you've also got North Sydney.
Yes.
Had a lot of new offices come on board and a lot of major tenants move that direction.
Yep.
Even Parramatta in Sydney has quite a big big commercial office environment now as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely opportunities, but again, like we say with residential, you have to be able to look at the how big the deep market is. Challenge, I guess, though, is in order for you to get investment into any of these commercial properties that are performing well, because the rents have also increased too. In Melbourne, they're saying that the average rent has gone up nearly 7% over the last year.
This is in commercial.
In commercial.
Yeah.
Yep.
Jeez.
So it's certainly one to keep an eye on, but how to get involved in it? Well, I haven't done the research, but it's obviously in the REITs or the funds and the trusts that are owning a lot of these commercial properties.
Yeah.
It'd have to be through the REITs. That's really the only way in.
Yeah.
What would be interesting is to see if things happen in the commercial property space similar to what's happened in the residential space in terms of a bit of innovation with fractional investing. So when you get into a REIT, a real estate investment trust, typically they have a basket of assets. So it's not like you're buying into one particular office building in their portfolio. They've got a series of office buildings and or industrial or manufacturing and or shopping centers, things like that. So you can't actually buy into one particular project or one particular location. But I'll be interested to see in future years if we get some innovation where if there's a particular office tower under construction in the Melbourne CBD and that's exactly what you want, well, then maybe there's a fractional investment to get you into that specifically.
There is one company I'm aware of that owns, well, I don't think they necessarily own it, but they sort of took over and then in effect strata titled offices around Melbourne, around St Kilda Road, Queens Road. There's a few that you can buy a single office and then have them property manage it and tenant it for you.
Yeah.
So you can own title of it, but that's not very common.
No, it's not common. Mm. And also it's a very particular type of property. I actually used to work out of one of those offices.
Yeah.
And as far as an investment goes, when you're tied into them being the managers of the property, you're tied into their management fees.
Yes.
And it's very dependent on the quality of office of yours. Compared to something else in that building. That's right.
Yeah.
So that's a tough
market. Be careful when
looking
at that.
Yeah, be careful. And it has similarities to high density residential apartments. You're effectively looking at high density office space.
Yeah.
If you're trying to buy something with a purchase price of $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, you're getting something of pretty similar size to a residential apartment.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
but it's just a commercial strata titled space.
And the challenge with that too is if certain tenants like to configure it their way and it doesn't always fit, so they look at it better. Mm. And you know, when it's not owned by, you know, different people, they've got the ability to cut up floors into totally different spaces to suit the tenant.
Yep.
If they get the right one.
Yeah.
The last stat that I'll leave you with on this topic, the total amount of office space in all of the Australian CBDs, 80% of that is in Melbourne and Sydney.
Is that
and
right?
That's, yeah.
80%.
So when they look at the total amount of square meters, you know, for lease in terms of commercial space in the CBD areas, 80%. And that's probably why the long-term average, they're saying, is between 7 and 9% vacancies. Mm. So when you're talking about, you know, Perth as high as 19 and Adelaide at 14, well, with Sydney and Melbourne down at 3 to 4%, well, that's what drags it down to that long-term average, given the volume.
Being an owner of commercial real estate does have some very stark differences to residential real estate. I can tell you that when we were negotiating on the current office that we're in at the moment, when the vacancy rate was up around sort of 6.5% at the time, you know, we were able to negotiate very strong incentives. You know, we signed a lease for 4 years and we practically only have to pay for three. That is a risk with commercial because you can often have commercial property sitting there for very long extended periods of time. You're still the owner and having to pay all the various outgoings while you find that tenant. And in order to induce a tenant to come into that property, you often have to provide them with rent-free or contributions to fit-outs or various other types of incentives in order to help attract them to come in. While I have noticed that with our most recent rent negotiation that those incentives have come down a little bit, they're still there and they're still being offered. It's another risk factor and another layer of costs that you do need to get your head around if you are considering to go down the pathway of commercial real estate.
Absolutely. And for investors who are thinking of getting into being the owner of commercial property, I think it's a different kettle of fish as well. Like you say, Joel, you need to have very deep pockets if you're going to be an owner of commercial property because you can have those longer periods of time of being out of pocket. And also, to get something which is investment grade, if you've only got a $500,000 or $700,000 borrowing capacity or purchase price capacity, there's not a lot of good quality commercial property you can get around that mark.
There's one style of commercial property that might fit the bill, but it's not that easy to find. Some of the office parks in suburban areas where they build a new office park and they're just small, and they are for strata title where, you know, someone might have a small plumbing business or something, they just need an office and some warehouse space. Quite often you can pick them up for under $500,000 where it's just a small space, you own it. And they actually have performed quite well as investments. So, and a lot of the time we see people that might buy it in their super fund for the purpose of knowing that they're going to be the tenant for their business.
Yeah, that's right.
That's kind of the only one I know that sort of fits that price point and would make sense.
A business owner who is going to lease the property to their own business from their super fund, well, there's a bit more of a guarantee around the rent being paid every month, and you're not going to have a gap in rental payments. Your tenant's not going to give you notice to vacate.
In fact,
because you are the tenant.
I've got a family member that's done exactly that, and they're loving it. It's working really well for them.
It can do. Absolutely. Interesting stuff, Brett. Let's take another break.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back, listeners. I'm going to touch on a topic of goal setting. And again, this might seem a bit airy-fairy for effectively a finance podcast. But I always come back to what the successful people do that the not so successful people don't do. And I'm not saying
success leaves clues.
It does. Well said, Brett. Yes. Thank you. I love your little sayings.
Little throw-ins.
Yeah, that's right. And what I see is that people generally who have a clear vision for the future tend to have something to aim towards and do better in reaching towards it. And I find that some people love goal setting. They love that process of doing it, and they love having that future thing to aim for. But then I find other people are pretty resistant to goal setting, actually. They don't want to do it, or they think it's a bit useless, and their opinion of it is a bit of a pessimistic opinion of books like The Secret, you put it out to the universe and then you hope that the universe comes back with it. Very airy-fairy opinion of it. And what I emphasize is that, firstly, you need to understand your current position. Secondly, you should have goals about what you want your future to look like. But if that's all you do, well, then there's a gap. So some people are naturally good at having a future goal and then modifying their behavior to work towards it, but other people are not. It's like when you come into work on a Monday morning and you sit down at your desk, what do you actually start doing? And for some people, they've got those goals present in their mind and they will just naturally just start working on the things that take them towards their goals. But for other people who are more habit-based or ingrained in their current habits, they just start doing what they've always done, like checking your email or working on a case or whatever it is. So I put an article on the UGC blog, which some of our listeners may have read.
Yep. You're a regular contributor there.
Yes, so are you, Brett, and so are you, Joel. Always interesting to read your information.
Good to hear.
This particular article was just a repurposed article from someone else, but it talks about the gap in between. So if you have a goal and you're working towards it, what you should do is you should assess the actual tasks that you're doing. So you might have done a goal setting exercise last week or last month, and you've got those future goals. But what you should do at a separate time is you should actually list out, what do I do every day and what are my tasks every week? And here's the suggestion. You list out what those tasks are, so you write them in a long list, and then you have three columns, so you can tick one of three boxes on the side of each task. And what you need to assess is this particular task taking me towards my goal? So you tick the box on the left. Or is this particular task taking me away from my goals? And you tick the box on the right. Or is this particular task kind of neutral, not doing either getting me towards goals or away from goals?
Pretty simple process.
I really like that.
Yeah. So it's this assessment process, and it means we're a bit more conscious of where we're putting our time every day and every week. And it helps us to identify, hang on, there's a task here that I'm doing, but what's the point of either doing this task or what's the point of me doing this task?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask.
And the point of this exercise is to see if you can either cull tasks or delegate tasks that can go to someone else, either with a better skill set or a lower skill set than yours, so that you can move more towards your higher value tasks. The good old 80-20 rule means only 20% of our time is getting 80% of our results. Mm. And the reverse of that is that the bottom 20% of our tasks is not at all efficient, is almost a complete waste of our time. Mm. Not a complete waste, but almost a complete. There's very low value tasks in that 20% of our time. And that's a day a week of a work week. If you're working 40 hours a week, there's 8 hours of your week that you should be able to identify that you can either delegate to someone else or you can identify as not in your interest at all and not taking you towards your goals, and you just stop doing it. Yep. And then there's actually little or no impact from doing that.
Well, hopefully a big impact in more productivity.
And then you can take that time, if you've got another 8 hours a week, or 1 or 2 hours a day of vacant space. Mm. Well, what's going to go into that vacant space? Anything. Anything that's more productive than what you were doing before. So that's what I'm going to leave it on today. So go through that exercise. You write out all the tasks that you're currently doing, whether it's checking an email or doing client work of a particular kind or research of a particular kind or meetings or whatever your daily and weekly tasks are. And then you rank them. Is it taking me towards my goal? Is it sort of not doing anything? Is it a neutral thing? Or is it actually taking me away from my goals because it's a time waster? And that's what I'll leave it with.
Nice, Louis.
Love it.
Thank you.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
And you can jump on the UGC website, ugc.net.au, click on the blog tab at the top for more wonderful articles from Joel and Brett and myself.
Very good.
Well done.
Thank you. What's next, fellas?
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Indeed.
Lovely. Well, you can't be serious about Tesla's share price volatility, but what's always more volatile than Tesla is Bitcoin.
Bitcoin.
Yes. Another one I don't understand.
Yeah. Trying to understand it is, I just can't from a logical perspective, but it's still going and it's still got that price volatility.
Yeah.
It was really... the hype of the world going back 18 months.
Yeah,
reached a price of something like $18,000 US per Bitcoin. It dropped down to $3,000 or something, and it's back up. Got back up to 15 recently. Now it's down at 11,000. Anyway, in the USA, the US law enforcement agencies, when they do drug busts and other crime busts, and they seize assets, they actually seize Bitcoin from time to time.
Right.
And they have opened up registrations for people who want to participate in a $37 million Bitcoin sale, because they have confiscated about 4,000 Bitcoin.
Really?
Over the last few years.
Wow. Right.
So if you want to participate and you happen to be a US resident.
So they're going to auction off Bitcoin.
They're going to auction off Bitcoin. So yes, they are for sale. And if you want to participate it, you need to be a US resident. You need to register by February the 12th. If you're a prompt listener to this podcast, that's less than a week away. And you need to have access to a $200,000 US deposit.
It staggers me how this can work, because there's a value attached to them, like on the market, yet they're going to auction it off.
I know.
It's like, well, I've got $1,000 cash. Who wants to give me $1,001 or $900?
That's right. It's crazy. Weird. Well, maybe there is a legal requirement that they do take it to auction so that there's no conflict, or I don't know. Maybe they want to do it off the exchange because that can manipulate the pricing.
Yep.
But I don't know.
Let them figure it out.
Incredible, incredible. Well, there was a lady just this week who has, just today actually, who has won $60 million in Powerball.
You cannot be serious!
Does she need some financial advice?
Well, she does. This is interesting, right?
Put it in Bitcoin.
I did a bit of research because I knew there were some whispers out there that suggested that winning the lottery is actually not the golden goose that most people think it could be. Now, the best information that I could get was based on US lottery winners, and it appears that according to a study by the Financial Planning Association in the United States, that one-third of lottery winners actually end up broke. One-third in the United States end up broke.
No ways.
And they cite issues surrounding family and friends guilting them into lending money. Now, in the US, they have a number of different laws that are they have some laws that are different to our laws over here in Australia. In the US, lottery winnings are taxable. If you give money to a friend or a colleague or whoever it may be, a relative, there is a gift tax as well that is incurred.
Right.
So there are some additional charges that we don't have here in Australia for those lottery winners. But a lot of the time, what they find is that these people tend to spend like crazy.
Yeah.
They get pitched all sorts of bad investment options and choices. They've never been good with money in the first place. Yeah. They get guilted into giving people around them money, and very quickly that money evaporates.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is just shame. Madness. Yeah.
There you go. Don't win the lotto, people. Don't do it.
I'm not taking that advice. I'll still like to win it. Louis, you're a musician.
I am.
How would you feel if you were a school musician, you attended a talent quest, and it was purely an instrumental thing you did, yet you get expelled for doing so?
What?
Crazy, right?
No way.
You cannot be serious.
Only in America. So a particular student at a school talent show started on the drums playing a particular song. Crowd started laughing, and soon after, the staff and the teachers put an end to it and actually expelled him because the tune itself was the Pornhub theme song.
Oh,
be serious!
Which brings the question. Not that I didn't even know there was a theme song for it, but it brings the question though for the teachers and staff to know that song. What does that mean?
Yeah, what are they doing?
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, that particular student, now that he's expelled, got a bit of time on his hands. I wonder what he'll be doing.
Come on, what else is on his hands? Come on. Oh my goodness! Well done, Brett.
Thank you.
Joel. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Good fun today. And we hope our listeners agree that was good fun.
Yeah.
And we'll catch you next week.
Okay. See ya. Cheers.